You're listening to the podcast for Inforum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Buy tickets to upcoming live events in San Francisco at inforumsf.org. Want even more Inforum? Find us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram as InforumSF.
On July 4th, 2014, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of the Islamic State, arrives in Western Mosul in a convoy of cars in great secrecy. I remember residents telling me that all of the streets were roped off suddenly. They didn't know why. He walks into the historic Al-Nouri Mosque, a famous mosque in Western Mosul. The mosque is full because it's Friday and the congregation is waiting for the Friday sermon. And then Baghdadi ascends the pedestal.
إِنَّ الْحَمْدَ لِلَّهِ نَحْمَدُهُ.
And he declares the caliphate.
وقال تعالى وَلَا تَهِنُوا وَلَا تَحْزَنُوا وَأَنْتُمُ الْأَعْلَوْنَ.
This is what Al-Qaeda had planned for years and had never succeeded in doing.
وَوَفَّقَهُمْ وَمَكَّنَهُمْ لِتَحْقِيقِ غَايَتِهِمْ.
In this moment, on this day,
فَسَارَعُوا إِلَىٰ إِعْلَانِ الْخِلَافَةِ وَتَنْصِيبِ إِمَامٍ.
ISIS did it. We can go.
Hello. It sounds like many of you are already familiar with the podcast, but for those who aren't, Caliphate is a documentary audio series and the New York Times' first foray into serialized podcasts. The series follows Rukmini, a 3-time Pulitzer Prize finalist who covers ISIS beat and is described by Wired magazine as arguably the best reporter on the most difficult beat in the world. Andy, who helped create both The Caliphate and The Daily, is her producer and her fellow reporter. I read that Vulture calls you the Dr. Watson to Rukmini's Sherlock Holmes.
I'm proud to wear that name.
Yep. Rukmini and Andy find out that a Canadian member of ISIS had managed to slip past airport security and return to his homeland in Canada. He agrees to meet them in a hotel room. So first off, I want to start with the difference between text and audio, and I want to preface my question with a short clip from The Caliphate. The clip explains the types of threats you, Rukmini, have faced from ISIS.
I've seen how I've become a presence in their online chat rooms. They talk about my reporting, they dissect my tweets, they sometimes insult me, and these insults, if I can just say so, sometimes are pretty funny. I think they figured out that I'm sensitive about my weight, so they sometimes call me Oink Meanie instead of Rukmini. It's Oink Meanie, like pig. Fat Machi. Oink Meanie, Fat Machi. I'm sorry to laugh. I'm laughing because I mean, there's something ironic about being fat-shamed by ISIS, you know? So, they'll make jabs about how I've put on a couple of pounds based on my latest, you know, TV appearance. But then sometimes what they say is dead serious.
Yeah, they're hilarious. Rukmini, as a print reporter, what do you feel is the difference between audio and text? And Andy, as an audio producer, what has it been like working with a print reporter?
So first of all, thank you so much, Shira, for having me. And thank you for all of you for coming tonight. I'm really pleased to hear some of you giggle at that clip, Oink Meanie Fat Machi, because obviously it was a bit of a professional risk for me to publish that. Andy had to convince me that it would be okay, you know, to sort of put that out in the world. And if I am being honest with you, after that came out in chapter one, I was contacted by probably half a dozen people on DM, on Twitter, on Facebook, who told me that they had immediately Google searched me to see if they could find a picture of me, I guess because they wanted to see whether or not I was morbidly obese. So that said, to your question, audio versus text, among the most obvious things is that you can be funny. In audio, you can laugh at yourself. Yes, you can do that in text, but it's much harder to do that in the context of a New York Times page one story. When you're sitting in your cubicle at the Times, and let's say that I was going to do the story of this Canadian recruit for the newspaper, and we're always, you know, aiming to be above the fold, page one, top of the homepage, there's this authoritative voice, you know, that takes over. We call it in the building the Timesian voice. And invariably, the Timesian voice is a third-person voice, right? It's a, you know, it's this higher, above-the-clouds voice, and that's not the one where you share anecdotes, you know, of this nature. And where audio was really interesting for me, and this is my first foray really into it, is that in addition to being able to be funny, you become a character, and you do it, you slip yourself in without drawing terribly that much attention, you know, to yourself, because you are the vehicle through which listeners are essentially engaging with this topic. So you are there with Andy and I when we walk into this hotel room. You are there when you're hearing about these threats from ISIS. You are there when this young man confesses murder to us. The ISIS beat is, in my opinion, certainly of the beats that I've covered, but I also think just in general of the beats that are out there, it's one of the most complicated and convoluted ethically. You're dealing with members of a terrorist group. You're trying to get as close to them as you can without becoming a mouthpiece, you know, for them. And what I found so exciting about the work that Andy and I were able to do is we were able, I think, to take you guys along as we are unraveling these things ourselves. You hear us grappling with the fact that we have just, you know, interviewed somebody who confesses to murder. What's the right thing to do in that situation? I've never been in that situation before. And you hear us in chapter 6 talk about, you know, the way that we try to take that apart. So that for me is really exciting.
Andy?
Also, thank you, everyone, for coming and listening to us. Ever listened to our podcast? I just flew in today and was reminded that this is an insanely beautiful place for you to live, and I was wondering if anyone would like to trade apartments. I have a nice place in Brooklyn. You can use my bike.
Yeah. I actually grew up in California. I grew up in Ojai.
I don't know why you would leave this place.
I know, man. I mean, like, seriously, why can't I cover ISIS from here? Like, why?
It would.
Yeah. Yeah.
We should look
into
this.
So the best I can do is I can talk about ISIS from here.
Yeah, this is good. Yeah, very beautiful place where you live. Working with print reporters has been really great. I came on to the New York Times September of 2016, right before the results of that presidential election that was going on. So it was a very interesting time to join the New York Times. And I was brought on alongside a few others from kind of the public radio world. And the Times had given us an amazing opportunity to experiment with, like, what was the audio department going to sound like for the New York Times? What should the New York Times sound like, is what they kept saying to us. And we brought with us this kind of things we wish we could do in public radio, but the format wasn't necessarily bending to our will. And then we brought all of these wild ideas, and then we had all that slam up against the amazing expertise of over 1,000 reporters who are working at the New York Times, who are just deeply invested in their beat. And right away we realized that there was a great vehicle for storytelling to be done through creating a plot out of not just what is the story, but how did the story wind up getting into the pages of the New York Times. Like, when you see Rukmini Kalamaki, Mosul, and then you read a story, you probably don't even read the first part. You're just like, New York Times, the story's going on about ISIS. But if you just see that, like, what does that actually look like? And with the creation of The Daily, which was our first big project that we launched, we really found that day in and day out, there was something kind of, I don't know, some kind of magical happening when you didn't just jump right to the story that Donald Trump had done a thing, but instead you started earlier in the day with a reporter getting an anonymous phone call and then following it up. And as the story unfolded, suddenly you're like, oh, and that's how the news happened today. That was it. That's the moment that this guy learned the thing that I learned, you know, maybe a few hours ago on Twitter. But, like, it creates this great story arc. And it does allow them, I've seen that a lot of the reporters that we work with, it allows them, a lot of them are amazing storytellers in their own right, like Rukmini. Thanks. And it allows them to step out of that Timesian news place and tell it in their own voice. But it also, it just, like, in our era of a certain amount of misgiving about the media going on in the country right now, it's interesting. It's not just a plot device, but there's also a way that when you see that it's like a real person who like really interviewed somebody, and then this is what they learned, and then this is how they fact checked that thing that they learned, and you learn all that. I think that in some ways it's also like it makes you lean in and maybe feel a sense of human connection to something like an institution that maybe seems as big and unpersonal as the New York Times.
Right. Yeah, we were talking about this backstage. If people only knew how unglamorous some of our reporting is, how often we're sitting on the floor, plugged into an outlet, you know, with a blanket over our heads to make a phone call, and people would be shocked.
Right. I had this moment whenever we were in Mosul together, and it was our first night there, and it was like a very amazing experience as a young journalist to be near the battlefields in this abandoned house with these soldiers and these local Iraqi journalists. And then there's Rukmini, like literally like, crouched in a corner because there's only one working outlet and everyone's cell phone is plugged in and she's got her laptop up and she's writing the newspaper tomorrow. Like, this is going to be in the newspaper tomorrow. And I'm like, people should know that it looks like this. Like, you don't even have a seat right now. And that's kind of the spirit that guides the audio department right now as we're trying to figure out what to do. And this is in some ways like our biggest experiment with that.
Yeah. So now I want to play a very different clip from the show. Mark, please play clip number 2.
I stabbed him. The blood was just, it was warm. And it sprayed everywhere. And the guy cried, was crying and screaming. He did not die after the first time. The second time or so, he probably just flinched over. That was...
How hard is it to put a knife into somebody?
It's hard. I had to stab him multiple times. So, and then we put him up on a cross. And I had to leave a dagger in his heart. And then there was a sign that said... it had a code on it. And like 166, drugs and alcohol type offense.
Yeah. How did it feel?
It just, at the time, it just felt disgusting but numb at the same time, like gloomy-ish. I just instantly thought, I'm a psycho killer now. Like, what the hell did I just do?
Yeah. That's Abu Huzaifa al-Qanadi, who's the Canadian recruit to ISIS that Andy and I first met in November of 2016. We found him online initially through Instagram, and we managed through Instagram to figure out his real identity. Through his real identity, we got his LinkedIn. From his LinkedIn, I got his email address, and we emailed him. And to my surprise, he allowed us to come up and to see him. And the fact that he had agreed to let us come made me think that he must not really be, you know, inside the group, that he's perhaps on the edges, maybe one of these online sympathizers. And nothing prepared me, you know, for this just unbelievable interview that we had there. To the audio text, you know, thing, there's an emotional information that I think is conveyed through a person's voice when they're speaking about something that is this traumatic. You can hear his voice catching. At one point, you can hear him rubbing his beard out of nervousness. And yes, you could still write this, but the quote on paper, you know, just becomes kind of this fragmented language that doesn't, in my opinion, get it conveyed as well as it does in audio. So that was the beginning, really, of this journey that we've been on, that interview, and trying to unravel his tale as well as the tale of ISIS.
Right. I mean, you're listening to someone describe the process of killing someone. As a reporter going into it, you very rarely get interviews like that. Rukmini, when this project was first presented to you, were you thinking it would look anything like this? And Andy, before you started working with Rukmini, what was the original kind of plan going into this?
You want to go first, or
So I guess my story is a little anticlimactic, which is that I'd like to say that this was my, you know, great, brilliant plan from the start. But in reality, what happened is that Andy was applying for a job at the New York Times. And in his intake interview, he said that he wanted to do a serialized podcast with me. And the person interviewing him at the time said, yes, that's sure, sure.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're going to do.
That's exactly what we're going to do without asking me. I don't know if it was a couple days later, a couple weeks later, our brilliant editor, Sam Dolnick, came up to me in the newsroom and basically just tapped me on the shoulder and said, Rukmini, do you like podcasts? Like, yeah, sure. It's like, cool, okay, because like maybe we'd like to do one on ISIS. Okay, cool, yeah, sure. And it was only later that I found out, like, what would have happened if I said no?
It would have been a different year for me.
Yeah,
for sure.
Exactly.
I definitely think, like, I want to say so much right now, I'm going to forget half of it, but from the beginning, I wanted to work with Rukmini, and a large part of it is because in her work, she manages to do this amazing thing where she takes people who seem so unlike people. When I consume so much of the media that they put out, and I see so much of the harm that they do in the world, and she makes them seem like people. Her work that she had done, even with Al-Qaeda, and talking about the ways that they have this kind of bro-y online culture, or the silly ways that they often will use kittens and lions in their Twitter profiles, like oh, that's a person who like is going through pictures and is like, that kitten is gonna be my Twitter meme, you know, like that guy's in ISIS,
right?
So that drew me to wanting to work with you in the first place.
Yeah.
And then my initial pitch of like what we're gonna do is like the five questions that everyone needs to know about ISIS. Like, who are they? What do they believe? Why would anyone join them? And like, I laid out this big pitch of like, this is how it all work. And then we did that.
It sounded really good, actually. By the way, I was like, wow, this is gonna be great.
Yeah. I'm very good at pitching.
Yeah.
If anyone needs help in that department.
Yeah.
And then we went. I started just hanging around with her, and when she did something, being like, I'll show up with a microphone to that. And we went to Canada, we got into this hotel room, and this guy came in, and suddenly I was like, you can hear it in the clip, I'm a very emotional person in general. I'm actually the most nervous I am tonight is that I'm like going to cry at some point in front of all of you. Yeah.
We can't talk about anything that happened to the Yazidis.
Yeah.
Or else we're going to lose Andy.
Okay. Yeah. But I never thought I would be sitting in a room getting emotional with a member of ISIS as they explained doing something that I think is rather despicable.
Yeah.
And yet, like, here we were having this amazing experience. And, you know, I knew right away that that I was going to have to repitch this whole thing and rethink the way that we were going to put it all together.
Yeah. And the thing that was so just incredible about that interview is we somehow, through really a stroke of luck, I mean, it's always a stroke of luck, isn't it? But really through a stroke of luck, we managed to get to him before anybody else, before law enforcement had interviewed him, before other media. There were two Canadian media outlets that ended up interviewing him about a year after we did. And he told us much later that the reason he spoke to us is Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the leader of ISIS. It was the start of the Mosul battle. Baghdadi had not been heard from for about a year. And he had issued this first audio recording, this first speech, where he essentially called on his followers to fight to the death in Mosul. And here's a young man who had, in his telling, just, you know, gone through this process of joining ISIS, finding it to be very different than he expected it to be, and essentially ruined his life, you know, in doing it. And he felt so angry at that audio clip. And that clip was released right before I just got in touch with him. And so I think two things were happening. He was really angry, and he also thought that he had slipped through the net. You know, he had gone in and out of Canada. He had gone on more than one trip to Pakistan after leaving ISIS. And so I think he thought he was in the clear, and that there were not going to be repercussions for this. And at the same time, he was grappling with what he had done and wanted to talk to somebody about it.
So you reach him at this kind of perfect moment.
Yeah.
You know, he thinks he slipped through, and you know, he's mad at Baghdadi, and he then confesses murder to you. What does it feel like to sit in a room and have somebody admit to you, essentially, in gruesome detail,
right,
the act of committing murder?
It was like nothing I've ever experienced, I think. I hope I'm not sharing too much, but in that moment, I actually felt afraid for him because we had already negotiated the terms of the interview. You know, he had agreed, you know, we're going to use this particular name, which is not your real name. The tape recorder was running, right? And I felt afraid for him. You know, he's telling me something that could in the end, you know, unravel his life and lead to the curtailing of his freedom. I have interviewed by now between 2 and 3 dozen members of ISIS, but almost all of them I interviewed in jails, you know, in Syria and Iraq. And those situations are very, very different. The jailer is there. They're admitting to crimes that they've already admitted to those authorities of the state or of rebel groups. And, you know, there's something tainted about those interviews. It's in my experience, this is a one-off, you know, where you meet somebody essentially in nature, who is under no sort of duress, you know, to speak or not speak to you, and who agrees to incriminate themselves. Other members of ISIS that I've spoken to in the West, they always tell you that they were just a cook. They were just, oh my God, the Islamic State had a lot of cooks. Lots of cooks, chefs, best food, right? Mechanics, body. I mean, they never committed an atrocity, you know, themselves. And so I think we just happened to get to him in that little tiny window of time. And literally, we were supposed to meet him the next day. And I think not even 12 hours after we left him, Andy was making plans to go the next day to his house. We're going to see where he lives and all of that. And, you know, I woke up in the morning and he was blowing up my phone with text messages saying that CSIS, which is the Canadian intelligence branch, had come and had banged on his door. And he initially accused us of having turned him in, which of course we had not. And that began a year and a half of investigations into him, which of course changed very much his outlook on speaking to reporters.
Mm. And of course, sorry, yeah. You want to add to that, Andy?
How it felt to be in that room? Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a surreal experience. I think that it kind of is to hear it in the podcast. I think my first exposure to the Islamic State was their videos that they put out, mm-hmm. where they do these awful things, and when you see it, you think, oof, what would it be like to be captured by them? You see the video and you think, oh my God, what would I do in that horrible situation? But I guess I never thought, what would it be like inside that black
mask? Right.
And as we were sitting there doing this interview, I was suddenly like, wow, we're inside the mask.
We're
seeing what the world looks like from behind mm-hmm. this mask as an awful thing's done. And it's surprisingly complicated.
Mm-hmm. And it's true, because when you see their videos, and their videos are so horrific, obviously, and you know, this savage cruelty, you know, that they're displaying, you immediately go, oh, the person doing that must be evil, right? They're, you know, this is a horrible criminal, a bloodthirsty, you know, monster. And it doesn't occur to you that the person doing the killing might also be having a hard time.
Right. And of course, the story of this young man serves as a vehicle for a bigger story about ISIS, about the caliphate, and about, you know, really sort of getting us inside this organization, you know, beyond the headlines that we often read.
Yeah.
Rukmini, at this point, everyone here pretty much knows this, but some of your most interesting reporting has been on ISIS and Al-Qaeda before that, and it's come from your collecting and studying of actual documents from these terror groups. Could you give us sort of a history of how you got into this? I mean, how did physically going to these areas, collecting documents about terror organizations, how did that become such a big part of your life?
So, I mean, I literally stumbled into it. I literally walked on top of these documents in northern Mali in the year 2013. At that point in time, I was the West Africa bureau chief for the Associated Press. I covered 20 countries in West and Central Africa. And in 2012, the north of Mali fell to an Al-Qaeda affiliate. 2012 was, at the moment when this happened, it was a couple of months, really, after the death of Osama bin Laden. I started covering it, and that was, you know, in the year after bin Laden's death. Because I couldn't go there, I did most of the reporting, I mean, all of the reporting, on the phone. And who do you call in that situation? You try to call people in these occupied areas. The phone lines were terrible. You know, you'd call and call and maybe get through hello and then try again. So mostly I called officials, as all of us do. And I got one kind of narrative of what was happening. So the narrative that was coming out of mostly Washington at that point in time was that Al-Qaeda had been decimated. You might remember the phrase, the head of the snake has been cut off. And you know, on top of that, they were saying that these little groups that were around the world that carried the Al-Qaeda name, that they were not really Al-Qaeda. They were just these opportunistic rebels who had essentially taken on the cloak of Al-Qaeda to make themselves look bigger. In January of 2013, French forces went into Mali to flush out these jihadists. And I and other reporters followed right behind. And I got to the city of Timbuktu very soon after it was liberated. And I was taken by locals to one of the buildings that had been occupied by them. And I literally walked on these documents. At first, I picked it up and I went, oh, this is in Arabic, I can't read it, and then dropped it back down. and then I went to walk back to my hotel, and then I realized before I got to my hotel, it's because it's in Arabic that this must be Al-Qaeda, because this is Mali, which is a French-speaking, you know, country. So even though I couldn't read it, I went back with a trash bag, and I began collecting the stuff that was in that building and then in about 10 other buildings. They started calling me the Trash Lady of Timbuktu. anyway, so I collected. I brought it back to my hotel, and I started translating these records with a translator. And among the first documents that I found in there was a letter from the general manager of Al-Qaeda, who at that point was sitting in Yemen, writing this detailed letter to the dudes in Mali, you know, saying, here are some guidelines for how to govern your area. Make sure, I remember this line, make sure to keep the lights on, because it's not good to frustrate the population. People need power. And on and on. So there were letters between these two groups, and not just like general letters. I mean, there were letters that indicated that Al-Qaeda Central was micromanaging, you know, this group. There was one jihadist that was disciplined in a letter, in a, basically a disciplinary letter that I found. And among the things that they reproached him for is that he didn't turn in his expense reports on time, number one.
Wait, tell him this guy's name.
It's Mokhtar Belmokhtar.
He's known as the One Eye.
The One Eye. He's probably the most famous terrorist in Africa. And he was getting expelled from Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb when this was happening. And so I found this, like, I can't remember, 10 or 20 page, very thick disciplinary letter where they elucidate all the things he's done wrong. He didn't turn in his expense reports on time. I love this one. They said, we find it very curious that whenever we try to call you, you always say that you're out of network, you're out of range. Yet, numerous reporters have managed to reach you. that could be my editor calling, right? Yeah. Right? Yeah.
Terrorists, they're just like us.
Just like us, yeah. And then... Exactly. And then the third major complaint is that he had kidnapped two Canadians and he had held them for a couple of months. And because he was so arrogant and basically a prima donna, he had negotiated their ransoms on his own and had gotten only the pithy sum of 700,000 euros, it said. And then it said, for two Canadians, ! Members of the United Nations, ! And you did it on your own instead of consulting our brothers in Khorasan. Khorasan is a term that they use for Afghanistan or Pakistan. So ransoms for these kidnapped Europeans and North Americans were also being negotiated by Al-Qaeda Central. So basically, my entire view of this group was just upended. And among the takeaways was that I can't trust officials to tell it straight about a terrorist group. And of course, this is the war on terror is among the most politicized things that there is. No administration can look weak on the war on terror. So every administration tries to tell us that the Al-Qaeda, ISIS, etc., has been defeated, decimated, the head of the snake has been cut off. And that began, I guess, the odyssey that I'm still on now, which is how can I hear it from the terrorist group? I think the most authentic way to do it is by finding their original records. That's very hard to do. I was lucky now with the fall of Mosul to be able to do this with the help of Iraqi forces. In addition, I try to talk to them. And then in addition, I stalk them online, as you have as well.
Right. And we know you went to these areas with the trash bag. So did they call you the Trash Bag Lady of Mosul?
They did not. They were very puzzled, you know, at they were very puzzled that people thought that this was, you know, of value. What was happening is military intelligence from Iraq was kind of racing through these buildings, and they were taking, from what I could tell, the hard drives of computers, USB sticks, and then a small smattering of papers. What I was told is that they were looking for actionable intelligence, which meant the names of people they could arrest. But they were leaving the vast majority behind. And especially the governance documents were not of interest to them. And the forces that Andy and I were with were coming from behind. And in many instances, they were burning these records.
Right. You say in the podcast that in one you show up and all these precious documents had been burned and
over and over again. Andy, on my last trip to Mosul, came with me, and he was with me for the first part of my trip. And I extended my trip for almost a month after he left because I was waiting for the fall of Tal Afar. And Tal Afar fell. I managed to get there, you know, on the first day. And it was really hard to get the permissions because they thought that there were a lot of booby traps and landmines in Tal Afar. Oh my God, it's so hot. You finally get there. And then you get there and they tell you, we've already burned everything. You know, that was, so anyway, with their help, we were able to collect, these pages of documents that have been really...
I was just
really
going to give what it looks like from somebody who like, doesn't do this for a living. And like, I worked at Radiolab. I don't know if you guys know that before this job. So it's like a different animal for sure that I'm suddenly in Mosul walking in to a militia meeting. It's like, oh, here we are in this meeting. Yeah. But there was one day in particular where we were hunting for documents, and we had gotten a lead that this church, it was the second church that we had searched, that this church might have been the place, the seat of their war booty department. This is where they were stocking up all the stuff that they had stolen from Christians and from Shias when they expelled them. And the military group that was in charge there was so confused by what we were doing.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, do you want to talk to this person? Do you want to talk to that person? We're like, in a minute. But first, what's this thing on the ground here? Like, I'm like, this is just like an AIDS test that an ISIS guy took. You don't want this. We're like, very much so. Exactly. We would like that.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, what's this?
Exactly.
And it was really strange to see that.
Yeah. I wonder if we could actually play that clip since it's relevant to that. This is the clip called Documents.
He says sometimes he says you're the first guy, the first people to ask about documents. So every time we find some documents, we just burn it.
Oh my God! No, are you serious? You burn it?
He says anything belongs to Islamic State, we just burn it.
Tell him you can learn so much more about this terrorist group by looking at these documents.
ودنا سوي دراسات على طريقة تنظيمية مالتهم شلون هيكلية الدولة الإسلامية.
هيكلية كلها عندي أجيب لك إياها من نظر مقاتل الوالي.
مو لازم خلال كتب رسمية.
وثائق رسمية موجودة.
Thanks.
Yeah. This is them being like, why does this weird person want all of these things?
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, these are documents that journalists and academics out here would, you know, give anything to give a hand. And with that, actually, I would like to bring in our next guest. Mohammed Hafiz is a specialist in Islamist movements and political violence. He is the author of Why Muslims Rebel. Professor Hafiz earned his PhD from the London School of Economics and Political Science and is the chair of the National Security Affairs Department at the Naval Postgraduate School. Quite a resume.
Thank you. Yeah.
Mohammed, thank you for joining us. And before I get to my next question, we would like to play a short clip from the Caliphate. This is humiliated.
Did you feel treated badly as a Muslim? Did you feel in your own experience here in Canada that you had been humiliated or treated in some way that slighted you?
Oh no, that wasn't it at all. Like I don't think that was a factor at all. That I was persecuted back here in Canada because of my religion. My sister, my mom, they've always been able to walk the streets safe. Everyone's really nice. My dad gets along with everyone that comes by to his restaurant. And it's just, you know, they're living a pretty good life here. But me, on the other hand, I always wanted something bigger.
We all know that there are many stereotypes around the sorts of people who join ISIS. Mohammed, could you talk about how, as an expert in this field, it felt to hear one man's story of joining ISIS?
Absolutely. But first, let me say it is wonderful to see such an informed audience, a room full of
a room full of informed audiences here, and to be on stage with Rukmini and Andy, I commend you for a wonderful series.
Thank you.
I've been having my students listen to it, and they absolutely love it. And not because they don't have to do the readings, but because it's truly informative and
insightful. Like a little bit of the reading.
Right. That's right.
You're listening to a podcast of InForum, an innovation lab at the Commonwealth Club. Support our podcast and find out about upcoming live events in San Francisco at InForumSF.org.
This phenomena has many myths around it, and this clip is particularly fascinating because it explodes one of the most dominant myths out there, and that is that these individuals are particularly aggrieved, impoverished, humiliated, they're angry, they're frustrated, and so on. But you hear Abu Hudhaifa saying that, look, we lived a comfortable life. My mother and sister could wear the headscarf, they were comfortable. We had a middle-class life. Mm-hmm. So this makes it particularly puzzling. Why do individuals decide to leave the comforts of their home country to go somewhere else? But actually, if you have a bit of a historical perspective, you know that a person like Che Guevara fits that similar profile, a person who was seeking adventure. And this is particularly what's interesting about that, because his voice peaks when he says, this is fun, this is adventure. So I think this myth that somehow these people are particularly aggrieved and impoverished is really undermined by that clip.
That's right. Rukmini and Andy, how did the young man you interview here, Abu Hudhaifa, how did he, and telling his story, how did that help you fight some of the stereotypes around ISIS fighters?
So I think that the predominant stereotype is that this is the boogeyman, you know, that these people are psychopaths. And obviously when you look at their videos, which are so horrible, it's hard not to kind of fall into that even ourselves. You know, like we had to rewatch some of these horrible clips when we were making the show, and it's so violent and upsetting that you immediately think anybody who's involved in this must be the most horrible person on the face of the planet. And yet my experience in interviewing them, having interviewed several dozen of them by now, is that it's actually just the opposite. They're so normal, you know. And in a way, I find that creepier.
Right,
you know,
that
they're not that different from you and I. You know, and that was something that Hudhaifa became a wonderful vehicle for explaining.
Well, even like one cliche is like you're saying, the boogeyman, and ways that Hudhaifa really flipped that on its head for me was. The moment of his conversion came at a moment I think we can all relate to, which is where he was watching those terrible videos that were coming out about what was going on in Syria.
Yeah,
I remember seeing those online and like wanting to do something to help.
Yeah,
you know, and in my mind that was like vote for somebody or like give aid.
Yeah,
but in the mind of somebody who had been taking in a steady stream for 7 years of just jihadi radical worldview, he had a venue to say, oh, this is the opportunity.
Yeah.
I can help these people. Mm-hmm. I can join this cause. And instead of, I think at that time in his life, he was like thinking about becoming a dentist. And he's like, look, that's not what life is about. I'm going to really go out and help people. And yes, he was going to have an adventure. He compares it to like going on a camping trip. It's not the most, I'm not saying he's the most mature person in that moment, but like, it is amazing that empathy was a trigger for him, and I would never have thought of that. And it's been interesting as I've gotten to know more people who've been involved in terrorism, because that's what happens when you hang out with Rukmini a bunch, is that actually empathy is strangely a common trigger amongst a lot of these people.
So you mentioned dentists. Many of the individuals that join radical Islamist groups are actually engineers, scientists, mathematicians, and so on. So they study the STEM, the same thing we want our kids to study, so they could have successful lives. And this is really quite fascinating how individuals like that who have a future ahead of them actually become attracted by this rather nefarious ideology.
Right. Yeah. Right.
I mean, we're hearing a lot about this particular character, and the podcast really delves into how Westerners in general are drawn to a group like ISIS. Can you describe a little bit of the process of what one goes through? You're coming from the West. You've learned a bit about this movement online, presumably.
Yeah.
What happens next?
You mean if you're being recruited?
Yeah.
By ISIS. Right. So... what I have seen in the case of Western recruits especially, is that these groups have become really adept at essentially weaponizing empathy. What they're doing is, once you get inside these chat rooms, and I'm still in them, you know, today, you're being flooded with images of barrel bombs in Syria, children being killed in this place. I've even caught them putting images that are absolutely fake. For example, they put out images from a gas accident that happened in Bhopal, India, several decades ago. It's a very famous picture, and I happen to know it because somebody I know took the photographer is a friend of mine. It's a picture of a little boy who's being laid to rest. He's died because of the gas, and so his eyes have become very wide. The pupils are dilated. And they were passing this around as a Muslim child killed in an airstrike, right? So they're bombarding you with these images. And we've seen in our own, you know, political discourse that people are gullible, right? That people see things on Facebook and they believe them to be true. Pizzagate, you know, et cetera, right? And these are often young men, also young women. Mm-hmm. They're adolescents, you know, they're not fully formed, and their heartstrings are just being pulled out. So that is the first, I think, sort of the first step where they begin, you know, they're enraged. Mm-hmm. They see themselves as part of this Muslim community, and they're being told it's one body. Absolutely. If when you stub your toe, your entire body recoils in pain. What are you going to do about it? Mm-hmm. And then in the case of, I think why ISIS was particularly successful, is they gave them something concrete to do in a place that was not impossible to get to. The jihad in Afghanistan, in the Balkans, etc., even earlier in Iraq, it was much harder to get to than taking a flight to Istanbul, going to Gaziantep, and being smuggled, you know, across the border. We're just kind of scratching the surface, but this seems to be a common thread, is using the empathy, the goodness in people, to literally get them onboarded into this terror group.
So once they get them to join ISIS, they then turn them into killers, as we heard in earlier. Mohammed, you mentioned that particular was really stood out to you.
Yes. So I completely agree with you, and I think I've studied foreign fighters that went to Iraq with the American occupation in the mid 2000s. And they build a beautiful narrative, not beautiful in a good sense, but in a sense that it's alluring and appealing. A narrative of three acts that, look, Muslims are suffering, and they're suffering everywhere. That's act one. Act two, Muslims everywhere have no one to defend them. Look at their own leaders. They're sitting on thrones. They're colluding with the Western governments that are attacking them and so on. But act three is a really important one. It's here the music and the hymns get quite animated. Young heroes like yourselves are stepping forward to defend Muslims, redeem their honor, take revenge at those who would humiliate you. So it's a really fascinating narrative. Yeah. But to the point about how they turn ordinary individuals into willing executioners, that is fascinating. So there are many things that are distinct about ISIS, their ideology, perhaps even their modes of violence. Right. But what is not distinctive, what's actually universal, is the mechanisms by which they turn ordinary people into extraordinary killers.
Right.
One mechanism I call bridge burning. So for instance, you kill someone, now you're on videotape.
It's done.
There's no way you could go back. Right. There's no way you could go back because now you have blood on your hand, and they could hold that against you. Another one that particularly comes out from that clip on when they were killing the Abu Nimr tribesmen. It's called diffusion of responsibility. Mm-hmm. You systemize the killing. You do it in groups. You have a leader. Mm-hmm. You feel that I am not doing this, but this is part of a process, a sanitized process.
Right.
And this is universal. We've seen this with the Khmer Rouge. We've seen this with the fascists in Nazi Germany and so on.
Right.
So this is really quite fascinating, and it fits the mold of other extremist organizations.
What I found interesting in how Huzaifa breaks it down and explains it is it's as if ISIS understands that killing, that it's not easy. It's not easy for a human being to do. This is the greatest human taboo, right? And so they have broken it down, it appears, into steps, right? So that first you do a communal killing.
Mm-hmm.
that, you know, there's six or seven of you guys, you're masked, it's, you know, you're not necessarily the one who shoots first, mm-hmm. there's a leader who tells you to do it, and then you graduate to the one-on-one mm-hmm. where the culpability is all yours.
Yeah. Another one is the displacement of responsibility, which is a corollary to the diffusion of responsibility. You say, I'm killing these people, but I'm actually not killing these people.
That's right.
They killed themselves.
Right.
And he said, I bought that. That is really fascinating.
Right.
It's
right.
an exact quote from Huzaifa.
Right. That's right. Exactly.
When you had heard that before when you heard it in the podcast.
It's common to a lot of groups. So think about hostage taking and when hostages are killed, saying, we didn't kill them. You killed them by not responding to our demands.
That's
really, it's quite universal across extremist organizations.
Interesting. Yeah.
By now, we all know that ISIS was hoping to create a real state, that they would govern and grow larger and larger over time. And as of 2 to 3 years ago, they seemed like they were pretty close to realizing that dream. Since then, we know that they've sustained heavy losses. Their state is essentially destroyed. It's shrunk down to, just a fraction of what it was.
Yes.
Rukmini and Andy, how did that dynamic of ISIS sort of losing ground as you were reporting on them, how did that play out as you were reporting the caliphate?
It really stressed us out. We were like, is anybody going to care about ISIS after they lose their caliphate?
This is Rukmini's mind. She's like, do people even remember ISIS anymore? I'm like, I think they're going to remember the Islamic State.
Exactly.
Well, let's hope that they forget that we never have to worry about this.
Yeah.
I mean, I think as trying to put together a documentary with Rukmini about it, we had a lot of problems to solve. A lot of how do you tell a story in... have there be a beginning, a middle, and an end when obviously the beginning of what is ISIS stretches back centuries, if you really want to get into it, and if the end is still undetermined. Mm-hmm. And in the midst of this, there was so much going on. And I think that as a person who was kind of trying to I don't even know what to call it, a person who's essentially documenting someone who's documenting ISIS.
Yeah.
What happened with the dynamic inside of the Islamic State became an interesting plot because you had things changing in the life of Huzaifa, mm-hmm. who had left this organization. But the question is, how much has he left that ideology, and how much can you ever leave that past once it's been something you've done? And then now you're having the Islamic State have to... They put so much emphasis on creating this Zion, creating this paradise, creating this safe place for Muslims, mm-hmm. and they didn't live up to it, and mm-hmm. kind of finding the parallel narratives in that. Mm-hmm. But that being said, I don't know, what has it been like for you on your end?
I mean, of course, my gosh, I mean, I thought that we were going to get this podcast out before Thanksgiving of last year.
Yeah, we both thought that.
We have missed so many vacations because of this podcast. I think I haven't had a vacation in 6 months. I don't know how long you haven't. But anyway, it's been a long process that has taken much more time than I anticipated.
Yeah.
I'd like to bear in on this because I think there's a good news story here, but also I'm afraid there's bad news.
Yeah.
The good news is organizations like ISIS are self-defeating. Mm-hmm. These organizations have an uncanny ability to shoot themselves in the foot through their extremism.
Right.
Actually, there's a kind of a paradox here. On the one hand, their puritanical ideology is a draw to a lot of idealistic individuals like Abu Hudhaifa. They bring people from different parts of the world because they're attracted to this sort of uncorruptible nature of their organization and their vision. To them it's utopian. For us, it's obviously dystopian. But nonetheless, for some, it's appealing. But that same puritanical ideology that motivates people to be there and to be cohesive makes them not work well with the locals, makes them fight with other groups, makes them kill a lot of Muslims.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the myths about this is that Muslims don't speak out against ISIS. But the number one victim are Muslims that are fighting against ISIS.
That's right. Yeah.
And so because of this paradox, they could bring a lot of people there, but ultimately they cannot really establish roots.
Yeah.
And here's the bad news. The bad news is there are too many conflicts in that part of the world. There are too many sectarian norms. There are too many grievances that could potentially allow these groups to recoup. They've been there before. We've defeated them in Iraq by 2008, 2009, and they reconstituted themselves. we defeated them again. And so I don't think you'll be out of business anytime soon. Unfortunately, I might add. So.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Sorry. As you say that, one of the things that I didn't know, of the many things I didn't know before working with Rick Meany on this, is that ISIS was actually so good at running a government that they were able to kind of get a foothold in these communities where corrupt governments had been for so long. And coming to where they're at now in the midst of their change, you start to look at the world and you start to see how many places in the world where something that seems as normal as corruption and bureaucracy, and yeah, look, we haven't got that bus system running, but you know, it's not like we have terrorists here. It's like you start to see everything as being vulnerable to being exploited by a group of people who might say, look, we're going to get things done. We're finally going to like actually address the grievances that you've been having for a long time.
In a few minutes, we're going to take questions, and that's really the reason we're here. We want to hear from you. We want to hear your questions. If you do have a question, please make your way to the back of the room. There are people with microphones. But before then, I'd like to ask you guys one last question. What do you see now? Where is ISIS now? What are the changing dynamics of this group? And going forward, where does this organization stand?
Sure. So, number one, the territorial caliphate, which at its height in 2014, 2015 was the size of Great Britain and encompassed around 10 million people. It's been erased. There's probably 2-3% of that territory that still exists. 2-3%, though, is still around 1,000, 2,000 square kilometers on the Euphrates River Valley at the Syria-Iraq border. And what's happened is we're doing the same thing that we always do, which is we've declared victory. There's now a discussion about bringing U.S. troops back from Syria. The Kurdish rebels who were really leading the fight against this group in Syria are saying that they're not getting the support that they used to get from the U.S. And so I worry about that island of territory that they still hold. Secondly, we know that a lot of them have returned. According to the Sufan group, which studies these things, of the 40,000 foreign fighters that joined this group from around 100 countries, around 5,000 have returned to their home countries. So what's going to happen with these people? As you see from the Huzaifa story, the justice piece of this is really complicated. What we have been told by our sources is Canada cannot arrest Abu Huzaifa al-Qanadi because they don't have the forensic evidence to prove that he has done or not done what he said to us that he did. And, you know, so different governments are dealing with this in different ways. The UK has been revoking the citizenship of these people, so they're now languishing in a camp in Syria that has become sort of the new world's, Guantanamo. French citizens are facing the same fate because they're afraid that if they make it back to their home country, there's really no way to lock them up. Among the people that are in this limbo are two of the Beatles. These are the ISIS members who kidnapped freelance journalist James Foley and were holding at one point 23 Western hostages and are involved in the horrific killings of those people. What I've heard from my sources is that the UK doesn't want them back because they don't believe that they can actually try these people, which is incredible. You would think that there'd be so much evidence given that several of the French, Spanish, etc. hostages got out and can perhaps testify against them. So that's where I see things.
There are two threats here. The first one is the dispersion of ISIS. A lot of them are going to be going to places like Yemen, to Libya, the Philippines. Some have returned to Indonesia. And in the case of Indonesia, we had the Surabaya attack where our entire family, including a 7-year-old girl, was involved in attacks, suicide attacks against innocent people. So the threat is real, I'm afraid, and so governments are really struggling with this. But the other problem, and this is a real tragedy from my perspective as a father of three, is that many of these people returning have children.
Yeah.
Some have gone with children, some have had children during the time of the caliphate, and the Western states do not have a policy on how to deal with those children, deal with the traumas, reintegration, and of course, if you're going to lock up the parents, who's going to want to take those stigmatized kids, who some of whom may have actually been involved in violence as well. So this is why I say there's a lot of bad news, even though we have fortunately defeated it in a critical war zone, but the problem will linger for perhaps decades.
I'm not an expert on the issue, but I will say that...
I want to make you cry, Andy.
Those are you guys the questions.
Yeah, exactly.
Backstage, I'm sure. The thing that I keep thinking about is how, and this maybe is like spoiler alert for our final episode, but just because the state itself has been defeated, you still see these ideas being very compelling online.
Yeah.
And this idea, it's just this incredible catch-22 because we live in a world where there's, if you are a jihadi recruiter and you're looking throughout the world to find propaganda material, and what you need is Muslims being mistreated.
Yeah.
It's not exactly like the internet isn't your friend.
Yeah.
Like there are plenty of things that you could tweak, that you could exaggerate, that you could use for this us versus them narrative. Mm-hmm. And I think that we're living at a time where the internet is creating us versus thems in surprising and scary ways, even in the most free societies in the world.
Yeah.
And the thing that I think about going forward, maybe it won't be called ISIS, but like I don't see them stopping in the nature of being able to turn a small fringe of people into a group of people who feels that they should abandon and fight against everyone else. So that's where I think it is.
Great. We'd like to now start take questions from you. I just want to remind you that there's quite a few people who have questions. So if you can try and keep those short and, as said earlier, end with a question mark, that's always great for our speakers so they know exactly what you want to hear from them.
Hi. Thanks so much for coming and for all the great work you're doing.
Thank you.
During the 2016 election, Hillary Clinton said Trump's words were a great recruitment tool, even going as far as saying that ISIS is rooting for Trump. I'm wondering how much of an effect Trump's words have had on recruiting ISIS, or if we put too much weight on his actual statements for recruitment.
So I was in Mosul, obviously, as the battle for retaking the city had begun. And my translator and fixer, Hawk, who's actually featured in the episode that just went live today, he's a native Moslawi. He's from eastern Mosul. And as the battle for the city was unfolding, you might remember that Trump issued this ban on several countries that were majority Muslim. One of them was Iraq. Right? And it's, of course, Iraqi troops. It's Iraqi troops that died by the thousands taking back Mosul, northern Iraq, etc. It's not American troops. And that ban had just been announced. And Hawk was speaking to a friend of his who was living in western Mosul, which was the most occupied, you know, area of the city. And at night, that person who was still under ISIS occupation would go up onto his roof to call my translator and friend. And at one point, he said to him, there's a bunch of ISIS fighters that were in front of my house today, and I overheard them talking, and they're calling what happened in America the blessed ban. Yeah. It's single source. It's why I haven't actually done, you know, like a story on it, and it's also coming from my translator. But if that account is true, it sort of gives you an idea of how these ideas are playing. The swing to extremism, you know, in our political discourse, of course, only helps to foster this narrative that Muslims are not safe, that Muslims are not welcome here.
And Rukmini, I mean, you and I both follow this online very closely. We've both seen actual audio clips and video clips from Trump, then repurposed by ISIS for propaganda. Sure. So they're quoting him as they try to recruit.
Right. Of course, I mean, keep in mind, they also hated Obama, right? So there's no secular American leader that would ever, you know, pass muster with this group. So we can't take it too far. But I do think that the kind of language we have seen in recent months is not helpful.
Hi, Hi there. Thank you so much for speaking. As a political science student, this is very exciting for me. Mm-hmm. So my question is, the podcast and you all have talked a lot about Western recruits. And so my question is, what do you notice is the most significant driver for recruits from Asia or Africa or the Middle East for ISIS? And do they consider the ideological fallouts between ISIS and Al-Qaeda and their affiliates when considering what to join, whereas Westerners are more likely to join ISIS because of its wider reach and more media attention?
I'm sure you have lots of interesting things to say on this. I'll take a quick stab at that. Just as ISIS was, you know, was coming to the fore, I had been covering Mali, as I said to you guys earlier, and I had managed to get in touch with the guy on Twitter who was running Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb's Twitter account. His name on Twitter was The Nightingale. The Nightingale, you know. It's a great name, yeah. I want to be called like an animal, you know, like...
Yeah, Hawk, yeah, the yeah. Nightingale.
Right, everyone the leopard. Cool or, yeah, exactly.
Requeen so, is a cool name.
Yeah. Anyway, so the Nightingale was talking to me on Twitter, and we got into a discussion. This is now late 2013, and he started telling me about how he was so excited about what ISIS, you know, was doing over in Syria, and how he was having these thoughts of like joining his brothers there, you know. And I said to him, Nightingale, I mean, like you're with Al-Qaeda, right? I mean, this is like a group that is having problems with this one. And the thing that was exciting him was this notion that ISIS was going to declare a caliphate. That was this really exciting idea, because as you saw in the very first clip that we shared, this is an idea that's been in jihadi circles for a long time. Osama bin Laden talked about it. Zawahiri has talked about it. But it's ISIS that decided that they were going to rush the timeline and do it now. And that gave this sense of purpose, I think. And I think that idea is universal. Westerners, people in Africa, people in Asia were excited by that. But I'd love to hear what you have to say.
No, absolutely. And I think what the podcast does fairly well is show that the complexity of motivation. So oftentimes we get questions like this where, well, was it the ideology? Was it the grievance? Was it the emotional images of Syrians being killed? But in reality, it's all of it. So you hear him say he was attracted to the ideology early on. He had this opening that he was looking online. But also he saw images that sort of moved him. But at the same time, he said, I wanted to have fun. Yeah. I wanted something bigger than myself. So there's really layering of motivations, and it's really hard to disentangle that. Of course, when you go from one region to another, even one locale to another, you will see different motivations. Uyghurs, for instance, might want to go join ISIS because they want to acquire martial skills, fighting skills, explosive skills that they could go take back. Mm. Others are there because they feel alienated in European societies and somewhere else where they could hold their head high. Some are frankly looking for, as I said, adventure, and this is an opportunity to get it.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
So I wanted to, again, thank you for the work that you have done.
Thank you.
I wanted to share something maybe a little personal, and then I will end it with a question. So, I am not an ally, but so I'm Iranian, and I've come here when I was 16.
Sure.
And in Iran, I was part of a, you know, school system that was extremely religious, and kind of having come here, I've gone through a transformation of kind of, you know, the ideological change.
Yeah.
And listening to the episodes that you guys have, and I'm like a big fan, there was two senses that was going through me. One of them was that I felt so kind of this sense of like very similar feelings that this guy was talking about around, you know, how outraged I am sometimes about some of the things that we do. I mean, US citizen, and now we're doing these things, and I'm like, oh my God, I don't want to be a part of this. Yeah. But at the same time, I started kind of remembering the kind of ideological system that I was a part of when I was back in Iran, and how, you know, vulnerable people that I very close to know now are, you know, in the kind of light of all the things that could happen in Iran. Yeah. And what's weird about Iran is that we are Shia, not Sunni, so I ISIS wants to kill us. So it's like, really, like, what would they do? And so my question is, maybe two questions. One is, what do you think is going to happen with these Muslims that are not kind of a good fit for ISIS and will become kind of, you know, traumatized and they want to do something? Do you envision some sort of a Shia ISIS kind of growing somewhere?
Right, right.
And the other question is, how do you think us as, you know, kind of people with the same background could kind of undo this and work towards kind of against this kind of propaganda? Thank you.
Sure. So I think regarding the Shia backlash, I think we're already seeing it, you know, the starts of it with the Shia militias, with, I don't know if you saw the amazing photos that came out of Iraq late last year by an Iraqi photographer who was with a group of Shia troops and was there when they tortured a member of ISIS. This guy, you see him in the photos, you know, strung up against the wall. So I think you're obviously seeing this countercurrent, and that is, of course, you know, a worrying thing.
Right. No, absolutely. So we have these popular mobilization units that are not just simply fighting against ISIS, but they have become politicized. They are getting involved in elections, and they're becoming their own foreign fighters. Some of them have gone to Syria. Some want to go to Yemen to fight with the Houthis. Some might want to even start something in Bahrain, where the Shiites are the majority, but they're ruled by a Sunni minority. So similar things could happen. The star of Hezbollah, which, you know, is not we would treat as a terrorist organization here, but is highly popular over there. What I would say, though, is that those militias are not likely to become like ISIS because they have a state sponsor, mm-hmm. Iran, that imposes some sort of cohesion and discipline on mm-hmm. them. Mm-hmm. I think if we in the United States become get entangled in hostilities with Iran, where it elevates to the level of war, I think those people could actually be turned against us. And so, and the military is often talking about the Iran threat network. Mm-hmm. And so this possibility is real. What we could do here is become informed first and foremost. So again, commend the audience for not watching the basketball game, but actually being
Thank you.
Here. And secondly, I think it is very important, it goes back to the earlier question, that we recognize that words matter and words from our leaders matter tremendously. Yeah. And therefore, to the extent that we could do something about that to mm-hmm. not fit into this polarized narrative of us versus them, that way we become like them. And so,
right.
Good question.
Just to your second question about what you can do, thanks for telling your story now. And maybe this is like because I tell stories for a living, but like that's a great thing to do.
Yeah.
And the more you could tell people that you can relate, and the more that you mm-hmm. can humanize that experience, and more that you could use your own story to try and pinpoint the ways that someone might be leaning one mm-hmm. way or the other, I think is really powerful. Mm-hmm. Thanks. Definitely.
This next one will be our last question. Hi, thank you for coming here. I'm a journalist and I write as well as do radio reporting and production. So it's very exciting that you talk about working in both mediums
thank
for
you.
The same beat. I want to ask about the archives and, you know, how you find this information from other places. Because I can imagine, Rukmini, if I were you, that I would do the exact same thing. Like, you're a good journalist. You want to find out this information for the rest of the world.
Sure.
But as I'm sure you've also heard, like, some people bring this up as essentially an act of pillaging of so-called Western empire, taking other people's histories.
Right.
And I wonder how you are negotiating with that.
Right.
Because other people want to have this documents, these archives from themselves and to know where they're coming from and what's happening to the people and places around them. And
sure.
Yeah, how do you deal with that? And what do you see as the right way to answer those questions?
Right.
Thank you.
That's a fabulous, fabulous question. And I thank you for asking it. So the very first big stash of documents that I found was in a village called Umar Khan. This is in the Nineveh Plains, on the eastern flank of Mosul. And these were the records that were leases for farmland that had been stolen from Shias and Christians by ISIS and then rented out at an advantageous price to Sunni loyalists. And I remember, I mean, the day that I found them, they were actually in what I thought was the toilet in the outhouse. We had searched the house, found nothing. We were with the Iraqi troops that were guiding us, and you know, I was sort of disheartened. Let's go home. And I thought I was going into the toilet, and when I opened it, we found it there. And I remember just looking at these things and going, "Oh my God! Obviously, this is something that has historic value." So my aim, ever since I have found these, is number one, to report the heck out of them, so that we can, you know, shine a light on the way that ISIS governed. But the second aim has always been to try to make these available to, number one, Iraqis for their history, for their ability to be able to prosecute these crimes. But secondly, also to the world. And since we found these records, my editors and I, we've been grappling with this. We've decided to do two things. Number one, we're going to create an online database. We initially tried to do it internally. It turned out to be way too complicated. It would have basically taken up an entire department, you know, to be able to do this. So what we did is we sought outside partners. We're actually very close to signing an agreement with a major university. I wish I could tell you, but the lawyers are just like writing up this now. And they have put aside close to $500,000 to digitize this entire trove, to create a friendly user interface where people from all over the world can go in and read the same things that I saw. And hopefully this will become a place where others will bring these documents, because sadly, there is no repository for them in Iraq right now. And there are documents that are still being found, right? But the second thing is, we have recognized that the Iraqi people in particular have an urgent need for these records. So as soon as we finish digitizing them, the newsroom is going to be giving them to the Iraqi embassy in Washington so that they can be brought back to Iraq.
Right. Thank you.
I think that was a great point to end on. Yeah. And I want to just thank everyone again. I want to thank Commonwealth. I want to thank the New York Times subscribers that are here. Thank you all again.
Yeah, thanks. All right.